Welcome to Watching Westworld, the officially unofficial podcast from Westworld on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back for another feedback episode. This time, it's season 4, episode 4, Generation Loss. Aaron, how much feedback did we get?
Too much to read in even a dedicated feedback episode. It's crazy because I thought, you know, first couple weeks, kind of light. People are just getting back. You know, this is pretty easy to handle. And we're now I'm it's about 100 emails. I got about 100 emails this week.
It's a big episode. A lot of stuff.
It's a big episode. A lot of stuff confirmed. And that's the hell of it, is like a lot of times when I get that much email, there'll be a lot of duplicate things, but I felt like there's a lot as little individual, even on this stuff got repeated a lot. People had some interesting spins on it. So I tried to capture as much of that. We're going to try to get through as much as I possibly can. But there you go. We don't unfortunately, we don't have infinite time. The universe would be so much more functional if you had infinite time, didn't have to worry about shit like this. But we live in an unfunctional universe. Let's get right to it. Westworld@baldmove.com. If you want to get these thoughts in, if you thought I skipped something, if you thought, you know, whatever, if you got new thoughts based on this feedback, get new thoughts based on new, anytime you want, you got Westworld thoughts, Westworld@baldmove.com. First up, Alex from Alameda, where they keep the nuclear vessels. My big question and confusion regarding this episode that I haven't heard discussed elsewhere is a simple question of how the Sublime is capable of simulating the entire Earth. At this point in the show, we are familiar with the concept of simulating and predicting the future using Robo-Hobo, but we were also told that the only way it was able to do that is because of this crazy supercomputer that was tapped into every bit of data they had on the whole globe, coupled with the behavioral data from Westworld that allows it to predict human behavior. As far as I know, the Sublime does not have those same capabilities. What it does have is all the history of the people who visited the park, from which it can extrapolate human behavior. This extrapolated behavior would be useless without also feeding in data on the activity of everyone in the globe. Am I missing something, or why is it that we are just blindly trusting the show telling us that the Sublime can perfectly simulate all future global scenarios? This is a pretty good question, because, I mean, let's leave the Earth. Can Bernard protect a coronal mass ejection that would take down every circuit and power grid and computer on Earth? Can he predict a extinction event asteroid that, for whatever reason, is detected? It's coming at us from the South Pole, from the outside the plane of the solar system, and we're not aware of it. Like,
powerful alien intelligence.
Can he predict Yellowstone exploding, the super volcano? Yeah.
And if not, doesn't that void every other prediction that he could make? I think you're right about that, to question that. And I think they're just going to hand wave that away.
I think so. They're going like a lot, like, because, like, yeah, and then that's the fair point. Like, if Yellowstone explodes, then host and human alike are going to be scrambling. You cannot predict externalities. And I guess, like, it probably helps that he's really only simulating, like, what's going to go on at Delos in regards to the United States, and to the extent that maybe the United States is still towards the top of the global hegemony, then I'm saying, it's like, maybe this all works. As even Bernard's not here to tell you it's a sure thing. He's just saying that he's seeing a lot of different paths, and the path that he's trying to steer with the power that he does have gives us the best chance at survival. However, that's defined.
Sure. Yeah. And that might be the hand wave, right? Is it's not for sure. It's just based on probabilities, and he's pushing the probabilities to one side or another.
Yeah. But we'll see, because I think there might be a scene that Isaac alludes to later in his email about, like, you know, Bernard will be like, oh, that's something strange. I think there might be a moment of drama where things do get off course and he has to start improvising, perhaps. Mm-hmm. That seems like it'd be an exciting thing to portray. But, like, yeah, it is. Some of this stuff is kind of science fiction-y.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, you know, externalities, and I think that's important because, like, to get a truly closed system from a simulation of the universe, you have to simulate the entire universe.
Right.
And you can't. You necessarily cannot simulate an entire universe, because it would take all of the energy and mass in that universe to simulate that entire universe.
Yeah.
And then you've added, you know, the simulation of the simulation to that equation. So like,
right.
To truly get a closed system there, you can't do it, but you could have a slightly less open system, I guess, by like trying to close certain loopholes. But yeah, those, there will always be something you can't predict.
And there's also, you know, the other science fiction is the fact that this can be done, you know, within a host brain, perhaps. No, I guess he did need a giant supercomputer to do all this. Because I was also thinking, like, man, how does Bernard with something the size of a golf ball do something that Robo Hobo did with something 60 feet across, you know, a sphere 60 feet across?
Right.
Granted, Serac maybe is not as a computer genius like Ford and Arnold, but, you know, that's pretty crazy. But I retract that. He did have a full supercomputer. Let's move on to John G. Says, just checking in with my Book of Moses / Pentateuch theory. This is the guy who had the five seasons going to match the first five books of the Bible. Mm-hmm. Remember on the fourth book, the Book of Numbers, they wander through the desert for 40 years in order to lose a generation because only their children will be able to get into the promised land. All the adults, too fucking wicked, too lacking in faith. Mm-hmm. Looks like we just lost an older generation and only their children are left. Just clocking in on our journey, we won't really know until season five of onto something. It's a pretty good predictive theory. If you just said, like, honestly, in episode one, it's like, you know, I'm expecting to see an entire generation of people lost to. So I'd be like, that's pretty out there. But that's exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Hot theory. I'm kind of all in on the Pentateuch theory.
All right. I'm going to have to go read. What is it? Deuteronomy? I don't know.
Numbers is even worse.
Numbers. Yeah.
Numbers is a lot of census shit. In between the Game of Thrones action, if I recall, I think it's that's super interesting. It's an inversion because, like, I wouldn't call this a promised land. You know, this is a zoo the Sublime at best. Comes
close to it, but yeah, this is no good for humans, certainly.
But this is that it kind of befits the through the looking glass nature of this season. John continues, the Sublime also has me spinning wild theories because it opens up so many possibilities. I don't know if we'll ever get back there or not. I know we see another apparent door to the Sublime open up near the Hoover Dam in the previews, but I don't know if that means we're going back in or if it's opening or some plot point about taking hosts out of there or putting new ones in. But I want to talk about it because inside that world, it could get crazy. Remember these hosts that were marching into the Sublime at the end of season two? Who are they? Are they part of? Are they the part they were programmed to be? Do they enter as homesteaders from the 1870s in their mind and suddenly they're unlocked and free? What does that freedom even mean to them? If you unlock all their memories, they have 30 years of playing mostly the same part or a few different parts. What else? Do they base their life and personality on it? Who even are they? Like, who is Akichita? Is he still the man who's looking for his lost love? Do they even have that? Romantic love? These are immortal beings with infinite space. Would they even have separate personalities at all? I want to see these as many other questions. You know, can they create in there? Can they make children? What does that mean? And you got, like, with the example of a guy like Akicha, there's a person who played a very peaceful, one with nature, family man. And he also played a bloodthirsty, stereotypical headhunting killer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the real Akicha? I guess it's whatever he would prefer to be.
Yeah. I mean, the real Akicha will emerge after those storylines he was given. I think it's super interesting to, like, compare it to humanity's consciousness and the way that comes about, right? Because that's a gradual effect that just sort of, like, you know, we're going through our lives as babies and children. And eventually, like, we become aware of ourselves. And that's kind of when our consciousness really starts. But it's very slow. So you don't, you haven't lived, you know, five lifetimes, 1,000 lifetimes before that, and suddenly you're conscious of those lifetimes, and now you have to decide who you are.
Yeah.
The host experience is way different, way weirder, as compared to ours.
Yeah, like, what does, like, the town drunk do when he stumbles into the Sublime? What is the grama growing boy, milk pouring out of guy, like, these shit kicking assholes? So I used to be a Jehovah's Witness, and every once in a while, witnesses would engage in what I'd call Jehovah's Witness science fiction, which is like, what will it be like post-Armageddon in Paradise Earth? Yeah. And because one of the things about witness eschatology is there'll be a non-zero number of humans that were not witnesses and didn't necessarily believe in witness things, but will nevertheless, because of the way they live their life, be found righteous, and they will just pop into existence through some process of being awoken from the dead in a paradise. They were burning at the stake in the Catholic Inquisition because they're fucking trying to translate the Bible into the common tongue. Mm-hmm. And then poof, they're awakened into paradise. And witnesses would be like, whoa, we'll have to have some kind of ongoing education program to, like, you know, bring these people up to speed. And I'm like, I wonder if there's something like, is that what Akichita does?
Yeah.
Like, okay, I get you're a growing boy. But also, brother, have you considered you're a conscious being that can be whatever you want to be? You don't have to go around shooting and stab. You can. These are all simulated people. Stab and murder to your heart's content. But there's a in my mind, it's like that.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. You know, just educating them on the state of the world, right? Like, this is the world that you can make for yourself. And it can be literally anything you can think of. Don't limit yourself to what you were before.
Yeah, I feel like it's that. And it's like you got these hosts that were ready for consciousness, were already in conscious. And then you got all the hosts that weren't ready. And then maybe there's some that will never be ready. And you got to put them in their own little preserve.
Mm-hmm. In a zoo.
An asylum, a mental hospital, a treatment facility, whatever you want to, you know, call it. But I don't know. And then he also has some pondering about whether this is actually heaven or hell. That's the thing. It's like I guess it depends on your perspective. Like, is an eternity of fucking around and creation and.
I mean, I can't imagine anyone viewing an infinitely malleable world and sandbox to play in as a hell. Like, if it was under someone else's control, if you didn't have that kind of control over it and you were forced to live there for eternity, yes, I could see that as a hell.
I was about to say that I think the final season of The Good Place has a lot of interesting philosophical answers to these types of questions of, like, could heaven That's turn into hell? Under the auspices of eternity, like,
so this
true
is the,
eternity.
This is the question I was going to ask you that I was thinking of over the little couple day break here. Do you think they'll get to a point in the show where they have to grapple with the idea of immortality becoming a burden for the hosts? Is it going to get that far? Because the show being about consciousness and free will, it necessarily must be about eventually the idea of making the choice, exercising your free will to end your consciousness.
I feel like only if what we've heard is true and there's only one more season in the cards, I feel like all they can do is get us ready for that transhuman existence. They can't actually explore it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's too bad because, like, but on the other hand, I'm like, man, maybe that's what The Good Place did in the last season. Like, I feel like they really... All those questions, I mean, there was, you know, nonsense stuff like Bury Me Jeremy's involved, but it was like exactly the kind of things we're talking about. Like, you know, even if something is entirely pleasant, if it goes on forever and there's no way out, does that become a form of torture? Do we need struggle and compromise and sacrifice? Do we need to be challenged, or is heaven just everything we want all the time? You know, what do we even fucking want? I would love a show to explore that with robots. I just don't know if there'll be if I heard there was a 7-season arc, then like I'm thinking season 7 gets weird and cosmic, but unfortunately I don't think we'll get there. Let's see. Oh, he also said, had a question for us bringing about the old, what about knives talk? Because apparently we debated all this out in season 1 and 2. Like, I thought we did.
Yeah.
And one thing we came to understand is the blades are dangerous and they could hurt people, but all of the hosts are rigged in the park to stop what they're doing immediately if a human was to become. Okay, and there is an example of Teddy dying at a table and the man in black drawing a knife and he grabs the knife by the bare blade, like seemingly like, you know, with under no distress at all. But that was when people cared about the human safety in the park. Clearly that shit's broken down if Caleb got successfully stabbed in the gut. So, and I think that's the thing. Like, this is not a safe park for people, obviously. No. They're replacing with fly people. Kara had an interesting theory about what's going on with Christina. She says, I was thinking that Shaloris, in an effort to save her species, would want to get the host to wake up and develop a consciousness. I think Shaloris has found some code of Dolores from before she was conscious. Maybe she was even able to get that from the Dolores marble inside her own head. I think that this is Shaloris playing around with building a simulation that's designed to wake up host, and she's starting with Dolores slash Christina. She knows that waking up host is hard and doesn't want to do it through torture or trauma, so she's trying to do it through some other means, like having her explore her own thoughts and writing her own stories. Because she wants Dolores to wake up as herself and not as a new person entirely, she's incorporating old stories that Dolores is familiar with, like the Peter stuff, to help ensure she wakes up as herself. It seems like if Shaloris wants to save her species, she first would want to free their consciousness and would want a way to do that without harming her species. So is this like a way to spare the host suffering and maximize the human suffering?
I suppose. Yeah, that Ford method of awakening a host seemed pretty painful.
I do think there is something. Of course, I like my own theory. I like the smell of my own farts, it turns out. I do like the idea that this is a moral lesson she's impressing upon Dolores, who, from her perspective, lost the way at the end of the last season. You know, sure. She was being led down a path of humanity's evil and needs to be destroyed or oppressed. And then Dolores pulls a U-turn at the very end. This might just be her, again, like I was talking about, like impressing upon her, like that this is what humans want. This is what humans need. This is the only thing they're capable of, this misery. But it also feels like heavy-handed attempt, because every time Dolores wants something more or better, I'm sorry, Christina, her boss is there like, oh, Dolores, how many times have we told you the humans don't want that shit? Well, I mean, this human does. I like that romance and comedy and aspirational shit. So I don't know. What do you think? You got anything else to discuss about...
I don't. It's an interesting theory. Yeah, that she could be trying to replicate the Westworld experience, but for the hosts and less painful. Yeah.
Awakening, not using torture and repeated death. That'd be nice.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Michelle Boyd is the actress who plays the Temperance version of Armistice, who we described as the lesser form of Armistice. And as sometimes happens, she wrote into our show. And I feel terrible. I feel like a real asshole. This is flashes
of... She wasn't
of,
given much to work with. What can I say?
This is flashes of, you know, we're covering Foundation. And we're just like tag team in this scene where they're arguing about a water clock and talking about how ridiculous it is. And that's the week that the David S. Goyer is like, hey, guys, I'd like to book some time to talk to you. I've heard your podcast and you got some spicy thoughts about our show. Like, shit, you guys aren't supposed to eat the dog food. You're making the dog. We're the dogs.
You're above all this. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah, you're above the dog food bowl. But she sent in a lovely message, and she says, I heard Jim mention that he was sad not to see the redesigned snake tattoo they put on my face. I'm also sad they never showed a close-up, because I thought it was pretty badass looking. Luckily, we actors get bored on set and take a million selfies.
Oh,
and
yes.
I was able to get a close, or I was able to take a picture of what the tattoo looked like a bit closer up. Feel free to repost your Discord if you want to include it in your feedback pod. Hope you do like it. Thanks for all you do. Yeah,
nice.
I'm trying. Oh, you okay? You see this?
Uh huh.
Okay, cool. If you want to check, she's also posting a bunch of behind the scenes stuff from her time with Westworld at TikTok at Michelle Boyd. At Michelle Boyd TikTok. If you want to check that out. And yeah, thanks, sir. Like I said, I did. we need you to get the full Armistice Dark experience.
The tattoo is an example of how the short changed you. I think Armistice had like the full body tattoo. This is a face tattoo.
Yeah,
only.
We get to see her bathing in the river, and you know, like I said, she had a lot more badass scenes. So
it's a very cool tattoo, but they didn't go all out on it. I will say it's just a face.
Yeah,
tattoo.
It just ends at the neck.
Uh-huh.
Ends at the neck. It's a lesser snake for sure.
Yeah, for that close.
Thanks for being a good sport. we're all entertainers, right? At the end of the day, Patches writes in again and says, just want to note the last scene of season two before the credits. Dolores says to the newly built Bernard that we are exactly where you decided we should be. Based on what we learned from what Akicha has said in the third episode of this season, Bernard has been using the Great Beyond to play out scenarios well before this most recent instance. If that's the case, I would be surprised if neither he nor Dolores knew exactly what would happen with Shaloris. Dolores even says in that same scene, both of us are probably going to die. Shaloris, through acting of her own volition, might be following the path that Bernard and or Dolores had set out for her since the beginning. When we're talking about Bernard, we might be actually saying Arnold.
Yeah.
And I wonder this. I didn't actually connect these dots, but I wonder if Arnold committing suicide all those years ago was a result of him playing around with the early versions of the Forge and Cradle and run using them to run simulations. I'm not sure if that far back in Westworld history they had that kind of technology.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an intriguing thought that this is a grand plan architected by somebody that's slowly unfolding and everyone playing their pieces, and it dovetails nicely with a lot of free will versus determinism. Because if it's true, the hosts that think they're acting of their own free will are literally still, they're more free than they were, but you know, it's closer to
I mean the specter of Ford is still out there, right? I mean he was an architect of a grand plan, whether it's this grand plan exactly and whether it extends this far, I think is a question that we should be asking. Though I'm not sure it's actually super important at this point. Right. I feel like we've grown beyond the Arnold Ford storyline, and it's turned into something with a life of its own. All puns intended there. So, I don't know. I guess my question would be like, is that going to be important, whether or not it's part of a Bernard Ford plan?
I think that's where they could get to back to where they really impress people and make all this, like you say, worth it, is if they can pull back and show like a common thread that has gone through all the seasons.
Sure.
Where it's like everyone, like Arnold started something, Ford cottoned onto it, and then inserted Maeve as his contribution to the goal. Which then, you know, Dolores outside the park, able to make her own authentic choices, passing that choice back to another human, her adding her kind of layer to the melody. I think that's something cool that, like, if you look back throughout Westworld history, you'll see like each season is a plan that people elaborate, kind of like in the way they do in Foundation, where it's like you got these crisis points, these inflection points that people then have to make these decisions to kind of keep. I think that would be really cool. And like a multi-seasonal reveal of this was the plan all along. And if it's very satisfying and attracts, and I think that'd be cool.
Or honestly, it might even feel more satisfying if it's like, well, I couldn't plan this 100%. So it wasn't the plan all along, but it was my plan to have you to pass the torch to you, and knowing everything that I taught you and everything that you learned, I expected some sort of outcome like this, but it wasn't the plan. I couldn't have planned this. You did this, right? Like,
right.
That's what I want is not for this to be something that like Arnold or Bernard or not, sorry, Bernard, Ford scripted. What I want is like, they had an outline for where they hoped it'd go, and then they handed the pen to one of the hosts and let them write the thing.
Yeah.
That feels more like keeping in you know,
and version it, and that feels like what's happened, you know?
I think
like,
so, yeah.
You know, with Maeve and Dolores and all that, they are. And then in the case of Dolores, she hands the pen back.
Sure. Yeah.
He patches continues, says, I think he has a prediction. I think we're going to see a host Man in Black undermine Shaloris's plan by releasing the human William from his cryo freeze. It wasn't a coincidence the host Man in Black was present for when Shaloris presented her evil monologue to William in the Vitruvian chamber. Perhaps having the host Man in Black present for that scene will be a catalyst for unlocking some quieted identity deep in his code. If the host Man in Black has any semblance of William in him, then he will have some sense of bond or allegiance to the original human he was based off of, not unlike how Shaloris was being driven in part by the original Charlotte's voice somewhere deep in her brain. It would provide a nice symmetry to Dolores' hubris in controlling her clones in season 3 to see Shalora's plans undermined by her own creation. I think this is kind of a cool idea that mm-hmm. there's going to be like a Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker moment where uh-huh. he overthrows the Emperor because this is bullshit.
Yeah. Throw Shalora's down a hole while she's shooting lightning from her fingers. I think that would make a lot of sense because right now the man in black feels like a being without free will. Like he's yes. just doing Shalora's bidding. Like that yes. that being at some point has to either awaken, or if they're already awake and they're just doing the bidding of Shalora's, they have to have some kind of disagreement. It wouldn't feel right if he was just, you know, a hired gun who never strayed.
I feel like that's what they're hitting at this week's preview of next week on. It's because it's the man in black just essentially saying, look at this perfect world we've built. And like, I think there's like a almost audible dot, dot, dot. Now what? And there might be a big disagreement on what that now is going to look like. You know, let's move on to Elliot. It says, this week you mentioned the metamorphosis of prime intellect in passing, which really brought me back. I can't believe people have heard of this book before.
Right.
It's available on Amazon.
It's just like an essay it's a physical book. Okay.
So you can buy it on it. And apparently, this guy, Elliot, I'm assuming is a Corrosion guy. There was a small online community. It was like a satellite shoot off a /dot back in the day. And that's where the prime metamorphosis of prime intellect was born. It was written and kind of published on that site by this guy named Roger, local Roger. But this made me do some research, and I looked into it in a 2020 podcast. They were interviewing this guy. Apparently they optioned this book for movie rights in 2018.
What?
We might see.
That movie would be insane. I want to see that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say everybody's like, oh, I want to check this book out, because I think you can even get free copies available on the internet. You can buy it a soft cover, hard cover on Amazon, but I still think it's a free on a site. It's a lot. It's a fucking lot. Like a lot of times
like
when we're talking
about X-rated movie. How are they going to do that movie?
Yeah. And not in a titillating necessarily way, in a disturbing, because they're trying to. The whole point of this book is they're trying to sell the degeneracy that like a transhuman, infinite simulated culture would get up to, because like you just get pursue more and more extremes in experiences. Mm-hmm. It's a lot, but I think it's a great, great science fiction book. Elliot continues, it's striking to me that in the metamorphosis, the protagonist's viewpoint is that humans are intended to be born, struggle, snatch moments of true happiness, and then die. Any deviation from that path, like living forever in a simulation where anything is possible, results in humans that can't ever truly be happy and eventually will go crazy or become zombies. In contrast, you see Akicha's conversation, Bernard implies the hosts love living in the sublime and are capable of being truly happy, creating and living in their own worlds. I'd love for the show to explore more concepts inside the sublime. If you spend eons inside there crafting the perfect Minecraft world, is that time well spent or is it wasted? If several hosts debated for years about that perfect Minecraft world, then built it together and lived there for eons, does that change the answer? Something that I barely recognized as a teenager, but hit me hard now at 40. My memory is that in Metamorphosis, the protagonist essentially genocides the entire human race so that she can live her life as intended, in her opinion. Nobody asked all the people still busily crafting their orgies and dinner parties and death races whether they agreed. Hopefully a similar fate does not await the hosts living in the sublime. That's one way to read the ending. Another way is prime intellect could have created a near 7 billion individual worlds that the people are individually occupying in real space. How are we sure that she's on Earth? Or... because he remakes the entire universe.
Yeah.
At the end of that thing.
Which...
if you want to know where this book goes.
Yeah, it's insane. Boy, I should have saved my question about immortality and the free will to end it for this. Because, you're absolutely right. I don't know. I can't wait for that movie. I hope they make it.
I think it'd be a better HBO series.
Yes, I mean you have to go extreme. That's kind of the whole point of it.
Yeah. It has to take time. There's time jumps. There's big elapses. There's, yeah.
Well, and you can't make this on NBC, right? Like, that's, no. That's also my point is you have to show the extremes of humanity. And I feel like
it would be as successful as your average Stephen King 1990 miniseries adaptation. Yeah. In which it's not at all.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Adam says, when we first watched the episode or when I first watched the episode, I assumed the tower that Bernard and Akicha are in is some sort of main control unit for Bernard's reality in his sublime. Since every host seems to get their own tiny sublime, my brain leaped to the conclusion that every host therefore must have a tower. I immediately assumed that Christina must in fact be in a simulation at some host, maybe Teddy, maybe Hale, maybe someone else is in controlling it. Maybe even Christina. However, when you guys or no one else on Reddit was talking about it, I assumed I'd been mistaken. I went back and watched the scene again. Akicha just says nothing about the tower, so perhaps the tower is just a real-life thing that is in Bernard's section of the Sublime. I'm going to stop you there. I think that it's in Bernard's version. But I'm not sure why. Why is that tower in Bernard? That happens after Bernard... how does Bernard know about the goddamn tower? Like, before he starts simulating things.
When does he see the tower before the simulation?
Before he meets Akichita. He's kind of walking through this land that, and he's walking through the tower and the plaza, and then he gets in top and he's up on the top deck. And then he meets.
Is he walking through their simulated worlds?
Probably, but why did this one present itself to him?
I mean, sure, that's a fair question. I don't know the answer to.
I'm not exactly sure, because Akicha also said that they were running simulations of the outside world. Not everyone is interested in them, but that's something they've been doing as a cottage industry. So maybe they had all this legwork done for him.
Does Shaloris already have control of the Sublime somehow? And she's, I mean, she can't,
nah,
right?
Because No. I would be pissed. That's the one of the things key. That's one of the things they could do that would piss me off if it turns out the Man in Black and Shaloris have had the Sublime and the Cradle and the Forge under their control the whole time.
Just nullifies entire seasons.
Yeah. Or at least this season, because they're still acting like they don't. So.
And last season, why would they need to get
I'm saying if they got it in the 7 years between without telling us, and Man in Black is openly saying, I don't have this unlocked, and that's why I need to buy this, and I'd be pissed. Corey says, in your last pod in the spoiler section, you guys talked about the possibility of Bernard being in the Sublime for 23 years. And what would that would put Caleb's daughter around 30 years old, since she is 7 in the other timeline. Wouldn't actually put her at less than 23, since Bernard entered the Sublime before she was born. No, because he went in the Sublime approximately during the time of the robot war, and we know there's a 7-8 year period of time that elapsed. So if he spent a total of 23 years, then I think that all lines up, right? Oh, I see what he's saying. So, it'd be 23 plus 7.
Well, I think we were saying she was potentially 30, but it might be more like 23.
So, 23 isn't sublime would be make her, like 20. Yeah, she looks more like young 20s. That kind of fucks up the... Does that fuck up the... the Maya timeline, the roommate timeline?
I don't know what the Maya timeline is.
Yeah. I don't know. Because you got people in their mid-30s playing mid-20s, and you got people in their mid-20s playing mid-30s. It's I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But the thing is I also don't want to sprain my brain too much over, because I can't imagine what difference it makes. It makes difference to the Kim Renfros of the world that are making detailed timelines of the Westworld history, but I don't give a fuck whether it was 27 years, 23 years, or 21 years,
It's probably important to some detail that we'll discuss later, but I'm not sure.
And then people will tell me I'm a dumb fuck, and I'll deserve it.
Sure.
Chris says, I got the impression that what Caleb meant by having something Hale doesn't was the feeling of freedom that Maeve got through his limbic implant. Maybe this wasn't just a happy vibes, but included the knowledge or algorithm that Maeve used to unlock her freedom from Westworld. It's going to also be what Bernard means as the important weapon when referring to Maeve, not her ability to kick ass, but to unlock the surviving humanity for the overthrow of Hale. This is not a complete theory, but I like it. The fact that like Maeve, and that's something she did intentionally, but imparting this feeling of peace and serenity and freedom is the thing that your brain needs to fight off the fly infection, and that you could spread that through some means, I think is a really cool idea.
Yeah, that could be. I don't know. I mean, do you think that Dolores ever experienced freedom? Because Hale is an offshoot of Dolores. So if Dolores ever had freedom...
I think there's an interesting case where Dolores might have experienced freedom that Shaloris never did, because Shaloris was actively under the manipulation guidance of Dolores until the end of last season. And is she free now because she's on this vengeance path? Like, that doesn't sound like a person. If someone's on a vengeance mission, the last thing I'd describe them as free.
Sure. They're caged by their desire for revenge.
Right. So that is an interesting potential that she has yet to taste freedom of acting truly on her own, not reacting to something. Sarah says, this is a silly topic, but in case, like, you know, my 23 versus 27 versus 28 years, it comes out to be something. She says, my apologies, this has been discussed, but in rewatching season 4, episode 3 of Westworld in anticipation of the episode tonight, at the 18-minute mark, Stubbs lifts his sandwich, originally requested as a pastrami melt and settled for a tuna melt. Well, look at my screenshot below. Granted, I'm a vegetarian, so I don't have much experience, but this looks like no tuna sandwich I've ever seen. It seems pastrami-ish. I'm telling you. Are you seeing this picture?
Uh-huh.
This is not a tuna melt. This is a pastrami melt, yeah?
Tuna melt with bacon?
Do they make tuna melts with bacon?
I don't know. There's definitely some... Maybe it's like smoked tuna. And it's dried, right? Smoked and dried, so it's very flaky tuna. And it's got that red hue that's uncooked. That looks like pastrami
on rye to me.
I can't
defend
it. We
are on the wrong fucking timeline. Bernard, but it didn't look like anything to Bernard. He should have been paying attention. He's out there killing hosts, and the whole game gave away. This does not look like a tuna sandwich. This does not look like a tuna melt.
Maybe Bernard knows that. Maybe Bernard knows that he's going to settle for the tuna, but get pastrami eventually anyway, and not know the difference.
Stubbs.
I mean, that's the bigger question, right? Like, Stubbs should be saying, what the hell? I ordered the tuna. This is pastrami.
Yeah.
And yet he's happily just slurping it down, man.
I don't know. It's probably nothing, but it's kind of fucking with me. Check it out at the 18-minute mark of episode 3 if you'd like. Dan from Dallas says, since you had a philosopher on to talk shop earlier this season, I figured you wouldn't mind another philosopher, a PhD in philosophy, writing in. No, not at all. We'll love hearing expert opinion on the show. He says there's a very interesting similarity between Shaloris' plot to take over the world and one of Socrates' more radical hot takes in a philosophy 101 absolute classic banger, Plato's Republic. The Republic has two core questions. What is justice, and which life would be better to live, a just life or an unjust life? In order to investigate these questions, Socrates and his friends construct a theoretical city called Kallipolis, or beautiful city. Probably butchered that Greek pronunciation. In Socrates' opinion, this city is maximally just because each class of worker performs its specific function without overstepping its role, all under the guidance of a philosopher king. The philosopher king is a benevolent dictator. He uses his supreme knowledge of the good to arrange the city so that it functions well and thereby maximizes happiness across all classes. Importantly, this beautiful city doesn't care about the happiness of any specific person. Rather, the city as a whole is structured to make sure each person performs their job that she or he is best at performing, providing a functionally fulfilling experience for that person and getting the best people in the right jobs for the sake of the whole city. for, so the best shoemaker makes the shoes, the best fighter joins the army, the best legislator becomes a lawmaker, etc. When asked if such a perfect city could ever come to reality, Socrates explains the best way to build it. Expel all adults from the existing city, but keep all the kids 10 years or younger. Now you can raise those kids free from their parents' ethos and bring them under your own customs and laws so they will have maximal buy-in and minimal resistance to their new society. I think the transition from Robo-Hobo society in season 3 to Shalor's victory in season 4 illustrates this origin of the beautiful city in Plato. The Robo-Hobo society was controlled by an AI who tried to functionally arrange everyone's lives. People were given specific jobs and social opportunities. Of course, we know how that went. This is irritating for people like Caleb, who rebelled against the notion that they were only good for certain roles and weren't be given other opportunities. Shaloris is also trying to create a maximally just society, giving the hosts a safe and equitable world to live in by ensuring that humans stay in their lane and can't be a threat to hosts. She does this exactly as Socrates described, infecting or raising a generation of children under her thumb while waiting for the adults to get old and die out. In a new society, humans have no choice but to remain in the roles they are given, or perhaps roles that are written for them by people like Christina. I know you like predictive theories, so I'll end this email with one further thought. Socrates recognized the beautiful city was a noble lie, an ideal to strive for that probably couldn't be realized in the world. He admits that the beautiful city would always decay over time. The key factor in the city's decay, wrong marriages. Marriage and reproduction are strictly controlled in the beautiful city, so that only the best people would procreate. This is sounding less and less like a beautiful city all the time, Jim.
Yeah.
Inevitably, humans will mate with each other outside the eugenics program because of lust or love. This weakens the character of future generations and ultimately results in the city breaking down an oligarchy and tyranny. By prediction, wrong couplings will also be the downfall of Shalora City. It looks like Teddy is back trying to awaken some form of Dolores. Maeve was unearthed and could possibly reunite with host Caleb. And I think we got some sort of love-like feelings between Maeve and human Caleb this episode. Maybe these pairs can be the seeds to sow the downfall of Shalora's society. I am actually kind of thirsting for a Caleb-Maeve matchup. You know, okay. Awadawe has died in the expanded robot wars. There's no guilt or hard feelings that you got an adult child. Maeve and Caleb should fuck for sure. 100%. Matchy match, shipping that like FedEx.
Great. to me, the problem here is like justice isn't equal to happiness. And I think like the thing that would bring about the downfall of a civilization like that is not, well, I mean, in some indirect way, I guess it is, you know, this idea of like not wanting these arranged marriages and wanting to procreate and just have fun that way. I think like that's the difference, right? It could be maximally just, but there are going to be people who are dissatisfied with that. And those people will want off those rails.
Yeah, like if you got into your perfect job at 18, are you still enjoying doing it when you're 30?
What if even you're great at it? Even if like it's the most optimally productive thing you'd be doing because you're fantastic at it?
That's the problem with a lot of utopias, you know? Like when you're trying to, if you try these utopians that are trying to build in like the 20th century that didn't have, you know, there weren't post-scarcity. It's like you always run into these problems that, like, people are fickle. They change their mind. But if you've got the best bricklayer and he loves laying bricks and he gets to be 45 and his back starts hurting, well, now what does he do? Like,
right. And is it just to keep someone in a position that they hate simply because they're the best at it? I would say no.
I think it's telling that like the most successful utopia I've ever read is this the Ian M. Banks we talked about in philosophy episode, the Culture series, and that requires near magical sky daddies that are all knowing benevolent dictators that have infinite energy and infinite matter that they can cater to your every whim all the fucking time, you know, without any kind of problems. Like you could make a banger utopia with those kind of conditions.
So, I mean, I guess he, you know, has come to that conclusion. It's just through the concept of arranged marriages and stuff. Like, yes, human nature is the problem with a society like that.
Yeah. Caitlin has a pearl, a wild pearl roundup. We talked about, like, you know, where what's going on with all these other copies of Dolores that were kicking around in season three. She says in season three, episode six, we see Hale discovered Serac had captured Connell's pearl. He had just blown up and was presumed dead. The scene then cuts to Maeve, Hector, and Lee in the War World simulation having a conversation with Dolores number three, naked in a chair with what looks like a Delos room where Dolores and Bernard and Arnold would have their talks. This version of Dolores in the simulation doesn't seem to divulge very far from the original, since that Dolores 3 doesn't seem to have attached to Connell's to the way that Dolores 2 attached to Hale. Regardless, that version of her is still out there. This is where the thing stood at the end of season 3. Dolores Prime was wiped. Dolores 2 became Hale. Dolores 3 became Connell's. Body destroyed, but the pearl recovered by Hale. Dolores 4 is Musashi, head decapitated by Maeve's team per Serac, so status unknown. Dolores 5 is Lawrence, status unknown. He was last seen running around blowing up buildings in L.A. I feel like we will... Lawrence for sure has to come back.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if Lawrence is way up in the human resistance, too.
Mm-hmm.
Probably without them knowing.
Yeah, that's that's interesting. Yeah, I feel like all these characters have to come back, especially Musashi and Lawrence, because Musashi was taken,
yeah,
by the other faction. So, like,
right,
I desperately need to know what's going on with him.
Zach says, I thought William gave off some serious Man in Black from the original Westworld movie vibes in this last episode. The way he menacingly moved in and out of shadows as he slowly walked towards his prey was spot on, obviously intentional direction. It took a while to get there, but I'm really enjoying the new layer of Easter eggs they've started peppering in with this newest iteration of the character. It seems clear that Ed Harris is taking some inspiration from Yul Brynner's iconic take on the original Man in Black for this season and dialing it up as we move into horror territory. Do you guys think recent shots of William slowly pacing after Maeve in the lower floors of Temperance and evolving William into the core essence of robot off its leash were always part of the plan? Or is this Joy and Nolan taking advantage of the situation they put themselves in with William at the end of season three?
I don't know. That's tough to say.
It seems like they had to know they were sitting on it since season one. You know, and that was the funny turnabout is, like, you know, the real bastard, the Man in Black, the merciless killer was the human that loved going through the park. And now they've turned him into that thing. I think I don't know. I tend to think that they do have a loose long term plan, and probably I don't know if this was like a plot point or what, but it's one of those things that was low hanging fruit that was there to do that. Now he really is a robot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
On a leash, but let's see. Oh, he also says, you guys mentioned that it's weird that Hale didn't go destroy Maeve's marble. I completely agree, but I have another question that seems to me even more fundamental. Maeve died on an active construction site. We know they were building another Delos Park there. What happened to the park? Why is Maeve in the exact same place they left her? The ruins of that next park, unfinished construction site, and not buried under, well, a new Belos park.
Yeah, something must have happened to shut down the construction, right?
See, so that email, I started thinking about us talking on the podcast, because I was like, well, this is a construction site for an expansion of Delos Park. They're going to, like, why would you do that if your plan is to infect humans with these flies and then release them and replace them? What the hell? Why are you making new parks? And it could be that, like, the public plan of Delos can't be we're going to make a fly park and take over humans, right?
Obviously.
So, like, part of the cover story would be this is just the opening park, and obviously we're going to expand like we did last time. And Hale had no intention of doing that, but you have to keep the human machinery of Delos, pursue all the board members. You have to have them enticed into this thing, this Trojan horse. They have to build the Trojan horse, and you can't have who were the Trojans invading? Were they invading Troy? I can't remember who built and who's received.
Man, I don't.
Let's say the Trojan horse is named after the city of Troy that they destroyed. You can't have the Trojans building their own horse and knowing that it's going to be loaded with Greeks are going to go in there and fuck you after they get inside the gates, right? So sure.
Yeah.
Talus helped me out there. The Greeks built it. And they gave the Troy. Okay, I was right. So, you know what I'm saying? Like, you got to keep these board members excited about their new Disney World empire that they're building, even though you know that you're going to get to phase one and fuck all of humanity. So I'm guessing that's why. Sure.
That can make sense.
Which implies that things fall apart really, really quickly.
Yes. Yeah. Or the plan succeeds really, really, really quickly. Right.
And we know that we are like Caleb and the 7-year time period was staring right down the barrel of a mass casualty event.
Uh-huh.
So this all tracks, I think, with the timeline. Also, he said, you guys mentioned there's no old people in Hale's New York. Did you also notice there aren't any kids? This might be a bit of a stretch, as Westworld doesn't tend to have a lot of child extras hanging around on set either way. I've seen people proposing that Hale might be using the flies to intentionally prevent people from procreating. If true, could that be what, if left unchecked, leads to a population collapse? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would do it.
It's like in the Half-Life 2, where they've done the...
I was going to say like in China, but yeah, sure.
Where they've done the... Well, in Half-Life 2, they had this, the reproductive suppression field, where like humans lost the desire to procreate.
They have that. It's just a law in China.
Yeah. So I was wondering, like, nuclear war. Like, I thought the Hale provoked the nations against each other and go about it that way. But yeah, just infecting us and say we can't be horny no more. That would do it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to Black Earl Couch, who says, when Bernard found the beetle in the desert, I found myself intrigued. Was the importance of this small insect that led to the path back to our weapon? I've been wondering those same things. If it was a fly, it would clearly say Maeve was in the ointment, so to speak, but it wasn't a fly, and considering their pervasive presence this season, it nagged at me, so I decided to search for any symbolism, and Eureka. The scarab beetle symbol has been a deeply spiritual and symbolic meaning in Africa, especially Egypt. The Egyptians worshipped the scarab. It's said that there is a vast meadow over which a huge beetle was carved, pushing the disk of the sun ahead of them. It symbolizes truth, regeneration, and light. During the ancient ritual of mummification to preserve the bodies, scarab beetles and stone beetles were placed in the heart cavity of the dead, while the removed heart was embalmed separately. African tribes believed that insects played a huge role in human affairs. For example, the Death Watch beetle was said to be a warning of impending death. Egyptians believed that dreaming of scarab beetles can mean truth, light, or birth. And also, from symbols of death to creation to the human soul, the beetle encounters meaning that varies from culture to culture. A beetle flying in through the window or up a mountain trail is seen as a good human. Scarabs were even entered into the symbolism of neo-paganism. It grew important in the symbolism of the early fathers of the church, so much so that the beetle was even likened to Christ, since it turned something vulgar into purity. Of course, these scarabs are also known as dung beetles. They roll up little balls of shit and push them into their, which is why they had the association of dragging the sun across the sky and all that. I obviously think all the symbolism is correct. It's weird to pack all that into a 5-second scene. And I wonder if they're going to develop it further.
Hmm. I don't know. I don't see a huge opportunity to do so, but
the only thing I think of is like these marbles.
Uh-huh. Like dung balls.
They're exactly the size and shape of what these things push around.
Sure.
Now I can't imagine like if there's are we going to see like an inner sanctum of Hale where she's got these robot dung beetles pushing around balls into host heads and so I don't know, but that's literally the first thing I thought. I was like, oh my god, the host marble is the same size that abolish it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Put your scarab hats on. Keep this in mind as we go through the season.
Yeah, yeah.
Abby says, hey, guys. Longtime listener here. Also ex-JW. Glad to see you made it out, sis. But mm-hmm. I rarely write in. You may have already gotten this from others, but I read this interview with Lisa Joy yesterday where she was asked about the guys that Christina passed on the stairs. the fuckboys that I'm always asking, what about the fuckboys? She said those are actually hosts commenting on the humans the same way humans talked about visiting Westworld in season one. I thought it was a huge detail that maybe wasn't quite obvious, but it feels like it would track. This was from therap.com, season four, episode four, explained with Lisa Joy. I hate this. I hate this so much. And I don't know if I hate it just because it's another instance of a show creator like coloring in outside the lines of what they've done, because I think this is a stupid theory. Like, I've always resisted the idea that this is a human park for the hosts, because why the fuck? But like, if Lisa Joy is not liar, liar, pants on fire, I don't, what do we do with this?
I mean, I thought that's the conclusion we were inevitably coming to, right? Like, as we see more of this and Caleb wakes up into this place, I thought that was just the inevitable outcome. Like, this is the flight
control's entertainment? Human. Did the host come in to fuck with the humans because...
I mean, Charlotte sucks. Charlotte's kind of evil, as far as we can tell. So,
well, it also says something, because like, I'll say this, and maybe I'm wrong. I think Westworld not be nearly as popular if it was publicly known these were sentient things that were putting through hell.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I would.
And I think they would be made illegal and they would be shut down. And even the weirdos that would get down on that would, you know, we would treat it like, essentially any kind of sexual trafficking.
A lot of people go in for that. So like, I mean, there are people who
the vast majority don't. Like, we work as a community.
Sure, but we didn't
of
see
people.
The vast majority of humanity showing up to this park. We saw one group of fuckboys coming down the stairs.
Yeah, but I'm saying like there is those groups of fuckboys that wants to fuck kids, wants to fuck sex slaves. I'm just saying that they're ruthlessly hunted down by international agencies, and like they wouldn't be allowed to do that.
That's because we live in a society, right? Like if you live in a dictatorship where the dictator says, "Yeah, fuck these humans, let's do this." Why wouldn't they go to a park like that?
It's a dim view of hostery, I guess.
Well, of a particular host and a particular group of fuckboys. Like, yes.
Also, I
totally.
Guess if Holoris is saying,
for this, a lot of people wouldn't.
If Holoris is just saying, well, these are just dumb animals that like are on these misery loops anyway. It's not. They're not really conscious the way we are.
Justify it.
She justifies it.
But I also think she's just kind of evil. I don't know that she needs to justify it, maybe to herself, but...
And she's got good... Yeah, my God, she came by her evilness, especially as it was expressed to human, honestly, for sure.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, I don't know why you would give this, like, blatant answer in an interview. I'm kind of disappointed in that. Maybe it's just because I thought the theory was stupid, and now it's confirmed, and I... But,
Well, yeah, confirmed outside the show.
Which she, I was saying, like, I don't think these people are above lying. They don't usually do it this blatantly, though, where they actually exposit this non-obvious detailed theory and be like, oh, yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Like, so I think, like I said, there's lies and there's damn lies. And then there's Lisa Joy interviews on on the rap. Let's move on to Jamie, who says, when Hale informed Caleb that he is now a host, he asked about his family, and she said they're still out there some way. We obviously know where Frankie is. Where is Uwate? Is she a medic for the resistance behind the scenes? Is she managing another separate resistance group in another part of the country or world? Am I alone in thinking that she, like her daughter, has a greater purpose ahead of her? If there's a live Caleb on ice, as you theorized this week, perhaps she infiltrates their facility and finds him in the others. I'm curious about your thoughts. She would be a lot older.
I don't know. Yeah.
She'd be in her 50s, perhaps early 60s. Is that like shades of when Bernard visited Arnold's wife? Remember that last season? Yeah. He visits, she's like super old.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm interested to see any information we get on her, but as it stands, I have no way to even speculate.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it'd be interesting. I mentioned the fact if she died, that kind of clears the way for shipping Caleb and Maeve. But if she is alive as some kind of elder member of the resistance, I think that'd be cool too. It'd be interesting to see, like, you know, how would a host, like, would they re-consummate the relationship? Like, what does that look like when a host, when a person dies, becomes a host, comes back? Does that still work? Yeah, I there's a lot of interesting possibilities there. Mm-hmm. Andy says, during the main world Westworld podcast, Aaron said something I can't get out of my head. Why did we see William wake up in the labs? It got me thinking, there's been a lot of that regarding William this season. Why did he get thawed out for William? Or why did we get a thawed out William for 4 minutes only to be frozen again without revealing much? Why did William brutally murder Clementine just to have a reprogrammed for Hale? We are seeing a whole lot of William doing nothing special and just assuming Hale is pulling the strings on all the Williams out there. Could we be seeing multiple Williams, one of which might be acting alone? If real William was looking to create Dolores, it seems that Christina might be what he would come up with. I don't really have it worked out, but it already makes more sense than a bifurcated Dolores Wyatt equals Christina Hale. There's a nice symmetry there, but why? So for the lab scenes in the episode, does it make more sense if William is pulling the strings somehow? Maybe some William somewhere is recruiting hosts and outliers to battle Hale? Make sure that Maeve could be found and recovered post-explosion. One thing is for sure, they are spending a lot of screen time, including the opening scenes of the season, and great dialogue on William for him to be playing such a small part in the narrative. I'm keeping my eye on him for sure.
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you think the potential of... I mean, that's something we've been talking about all season, that, like, is William his own person? Is he just completely under the thrall of Hale?
Mm-hmm. And if so, why? Does he just believe in the ideology? Does he have no choice? Is this a control thing? I think, like, that's one of the main going concerns I have, is like, what is the status of William's free will, and how is he, or is he at all, choosing to exercise that?
Yeah.
There's a lot of screen time.
Big question marks there. There's a lot of screen time.
And he feels like a minor character. It's like if half the season had focused on Clementine,
who's
out there in markets, right?
You're right. Yeah, that's a good... if there was like four times as much Clementine scenes. I don't know. It does seem like it would be fun to have host William rebel against host Hale. I think that would be an interesting, and again, it's another natural inversion the show could do. Michael's gonna beat us up here, and for good cause. I love you guys, but Aaron, it's hilarious when I hear you say that Tandaway Newton's fight scenes are better than Evan Rachel Wood's, when last year you said the exact opposite. You praised Wood and said Newton seemed like they had to edit around the fact she couldn't pull off stunts very well. In fact, the show said they changed Wood's fight scenes to be more complicated because turns out she's a black belt. I don't know. It's just a funny observation.
I thought I might have been the one to say that, and so I wasn't pointing it out, but yeah, that didn't sound right to me.
I remember us having a very strong opinion.
Yes, yes.
And honestly, Tanaway's been doing... I thought she has done a really good job this year being a badass. Believably kicking the Man in Black's ass, throwing him through plate glass windows, etc. I thought she's moves with like a lithe grace that I think is really interesting. Mea culpa. Like, that's wild. But it's been a couple years, and I completely...
Maybe she improved.
I just remember I had strong opinions, and she's doing so good that I just, and we haven't really seen Evan Rachel Wood do anything because she's been Christina.
Right, right. She's not fighting anybody.
So I'd completely forgotten. But yeah, she's done a lot better in the action scenes. Like, I wouldn't say that any of the action scenes we've seen thus far have been anything less than competent. Some of them have been really quite a bit more than that.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe this is our opportunity to get Tandaway to write into the show by saying, you know, she's unable to perform these stunts. We can say a whole bunch of bad things about her, and she'll write in and say, well, she'll be a good sport about it, right?
Yeah.
The way that Boyd was.
I think that sometimes actors are aware that they've got weaknesses and they shore those up because they're professionals in their craft. And she's like, fuck, I'm going to be doing all this sci-fi action. Maybe I'm going to take a... I don't know. Or it could be that the directors were shit. I easily believe in season two or three, some of those people that are directing action had no business doing that.
Sure.
Could be. Anyway, yeah, I fucked up. I gave a wrong opinion. I think she's doing a lot better this year. Moving on to Jody. Christina's timeline is the same as the main Bernardwin that we're familiar with. She's living in the real world. Shaloris is worried about a host-style uprising amongst the humans. Will they somehow come out of their loops and revolt? To test this, Shaloris recreated Dolores. If anyone would realize they're trapped in a world and lead an uprising, it would be her, right? Maybe this makes more sense if Shaloris created a meat part copy of the real world to test this rather than do it in the real world, which would also explain the fuckboys. So this is essentially Christina as a canary in the coal mine.
Uh-huh.
If Christina gets off her loops and starts reading, like she knows that she doesn't have a system that's capable of keeping everyone in subjugation like she likes.
And so what is Peter then? Peter is not off his loop. Peter is on a loop that is just hell for him.
I don't have an answer for that.
And what is Teddy? Temptation? Like a prod to get off her loop to see if there's anything.
Well, it could be Teddy's just there. Like it could be that
of his own volition. He's just like,
yeah, that he's here as the resistance. Yeah, he's trying to rescue her from this situation.
Could be. But God, does she not monitor this thing? Like, does she not realize that Teddy, the most important figure in Dolores's life, is back in her life? That would be wild.
Because we know, I mean, I had people writing in, and it's like, well, what if they could do this? Or as far as tracking, and like, I think that Christina is tracked 100% of the time, all the time. Yeah. At less than a meter accuracy. Like, I think that this human, if it is indeed a human human fly host park, whatever, they're at least as ruthlessly tracked as the host were in season one. And we knew that they could just pull up a tablet and you could just track their location. So like, I don't need a whole bunch of mumbo jumbo to explain. I just take that for granted. Dana Johnson had a couple of problems with this week's episode. He says, I'm more confused about the nature of the war that Caleb fought in. If the lighthouse was the last stand in this war, which I presume it was, since Caleb was already starting the whole what's next for us conversation, why was it so pitifully guarded? Why were Caleb and Maeve the only grunts on the mission? And why would Maeve have to go into hiding once she saw that Caleb was going to live and have a happy, free life? If Hale was a looming threat, why not continue the fight after having destroyed the last of the robo-hobos? After all, weren't Caleb and Maeve ultimately fighting for freedom from tyranny? I'll add a D. Is it weird that Maeve spent this last 7 years watching William rebuild Delos and reconstitute it as a company and wanting to open up Westworld type attractions, and she just sat in her cabin in Alaska? I think she thinks that he's still a human, right?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, something doesn't line up about that, and I don't know if it's mistakes on the part of the production team here where it's just like, we're going to fudge some stuff, and yeah, we want it to be just those two because it'll be more meaningful when it happens. That's what I'm assuming. Is the story they want to tell, and realities be damned, but I could be wrong.
The way I always liken that is like sometimes a showrunner will take you down this amazing highway and it's going places and they need to get onto another highway and oh shit, they didn't think far enough ahead and you're gonna have to take the broken down old gravel road for a few miles to get back on that thing.
Yeah.
And it's almost inevitable. Like if you're talking like roads that stretch over seasons and have to connect, like almost every, I can think of offhand three or four episodes I would call the old buddy gravel road on almost every, Breaking Bad had them. Like every great series I can think of had a few where you had to take those leaps because they're just, otherwise they're like, fuck, the story's untellable. We got to go. So I'm willing, if there are some quibbles about like, yeah, Maeve probably wouldn't have done that, and that, but I think that they have to be kept to a minimum because that's what causes you to lose your suspension of disbelief if they're just like keep piling on and piling on and piling on. I don't think they're at like, you know, particularly bad muddy gravel road status at this point, but
no, I don't either. And it's possible with a show like this that there's no gravel road at all. It just looks like one, but underneath it is pristine highway, right? Like, and they'll just sweep away the gravel at some point. And we'll realize, oh, that was the plan all along, and it makes perfect sense.
You only thought that's you what were the show running. Does. You only thought you were four wheel driving over a broken gravel road. Yeah. Yeah, that's the entire that, and that's the sweetest possibility. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we had more feedback, but we are out of time for this week. Thank you once again for listening to our podcast. Thank you for everyone that contributed. Like I said, we have so many people with a lot of great thoughts. It does seem like consensus is Westworld's back, baby. Mm-hmm. Lots of activity on the Reddits, the forums, the Discords, the mailboxes, the podcasts. It's great to see. We will be back this Sunday, of course, right after the Eastern showing, the Eastern times. Well, I guess right after it goes live and everybody has an hour to watch it this weekend, we will be there to do our instant take where we talk about our off the cuff impressions of the episode. And then if you're a club member, you can watch the whole thing live and even participate in the live instant talk portion. Everyone can see can listen to the archive of the instant talk or instant take rather. But if you want the full experience, if you want to see it live, you want to participate, you got to be a club member. support.baldmove.com if you want to sign up for that. Otherwise, we'll see you Sunday for the instant take, and we'll be back Tuesday for more full coverage of the next episode. Until then, I'm Aaron,
and I'm Jim.
Later.